Monday, March 14th, opening the subcommittee of the House Committee on Water. And have I rushed you too much, Sandy, or do you have any agenda items that you wish to clarify for us?
No points of clarification, sir, at this point.
Okay. At this point, then, we would move to open a public hearing on House Bill 2473. We have folks to testify on that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2473 was brought before us at the request of Representative Butler. I chatted with their office last week when we scheduled it. They do know that this bill is before us. We have a couple of folks in opposition to the bill, but I don't have anybody here supporting the bill and to provide us with background on it. What this bill is requesting is that we allow the use of groundwater without compliance with registration certificate or other permit requirements for watering lawns, grounds, or fields of public or private kindergarten through grade 12 schools.
Okay.
If we want to ask.
Mr. Chair.
He may know, but I don't.
We have a sign-up sheet here. Is there anyone who has not signed up that wishes to sign up to offer testimony on this bill?
On House Bill 2473.
2473.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. With that, at this point, let's hear from the naysayers, and we'll start out with the good Adam Sussman from the Water Resources Department, telling us why this is not exactly what he was wanting to come and testify about today.
Beg your pardon. Good afternoon, Adam.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Adam Sussman. I'm with the Oregon Department of Water Resources, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify on House Bill 2473. And as the chair has indicated, the department, the Water Resources Department, does not support House Bill 2473.
Excuse me just a moment, Adam. We will close the subcommittee and open the floor. House Water Committee at this point, and continue with our presentation against House Bill 2473.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I provided you some written testimony that you can read at your leisure. I really want to make three specific points about the bill. Number one, I would like the committee to understand that under current law, there are a number of groundwater uses that are exempt from the requirement to obtain a permit. And what being exempt from that requirement means is that there's no evaluation by the department prior to that use being initiated. In other words, the department doesn't have an opportunity to evaluate the groundwater resource to see if water is available. And more importantly, it doesn't have an opportunity to evaluate how that use of groundwater might impact existing surface water and groundwater users. The use of groundwater as an exempt use has been an ongoing discussion with the Water Resources Commission and a number of water use stakeholders around the state, and there's been a fair amount of concern expressed about the already exempt groundwater uses that, for the most part, are generally de minimis uses. And if we go the direction as proposed in House Bill 2473, this could allow significant new uses of groundwater without the requirement to obtain a permit statewide. We are quite concerned how this will impact other well users in the state and other water right holders in the state. Now, in addition, point number two is that you need to understand, the committee needs to understand that an exempt use of groundwater doesn't necessarily mean a secure long-term water supply. In other words, even though you may be allowed to initiate a use of groundwater without obtaining a permit, you're still part of the state's prior appropriation regulatory scheme, which means you may initiate this use without having to obtain a permit and then find yourself being regulated or curtailed to protect existing water users in the state. And if you have any sort of connection to surface water, you would be particularly vulnerable, especially in a dry year such as this, where many senior surface water rights may be not met. So that's my second point. It's not necessarily a long-term water supply. And thirdly, the department does understand that this bill may be a result of a specific situation where a school is struggling with a long-term water supply, and we're aware of that. The department staff in that area have been diligently working with that school and the community to find a long-term supply, something like a water right transfer or a permit amendment. And in our view, we believe this problem simply can be resolved without changing the state's groundwater management structure as it is today. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Reiterate that the department is unable to support this bill.
Okay, any questions?
Yes. Representative Cuomo. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Adam, I just want to make sure that I kind of clarify this a little bit. Is it in Section 1, then, is that where the necessity of getting a permit is taken out the way Section 1 is written?
Mr. Chair and Representative Crummell, that's correct. Under Section 1, there's a number of amendments, but that is the list of uses that are exempt from the requirement to obtain a permit.
Okay, follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
Thank you. Then is it in, I guess it would be Section 1, Subsection 3, is that, am I reading this correctly, and that that's where it is pointing out what you have pointed out, that even if they had the authority to use the groundwater, they still then would not be able to, if there was a senior user ahead of them, they would not be able to overcome that senior user? Am I correct in that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, that's correct. They'd still be subject to the state's water use regulation.
So, follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So probably to actually get the effect that the potential proponents of the bill are going after, subsection 3 of Section 1 would also need to be deleted language from the current statute?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, certainly the two correct go together, but as I reiterated in my testimony, if they were interested in a long-term secure water supply, we might look at a deeper well or transferring an existing water right.
Thank you. And one more follow-up, Mr. Chair. Is this type of request usually brought on because a user may not be actually developing their well to its full potential? In other words, they may not be as deep in the aquifer as they ought to be in order to exercise their right completely.
Mr. Chair, Representative Crum, I'm not sure I understand question. When you say this type of request, do you mean this type of bill?
Yes, this type of bill.
Okay. Representative Jensen and Representative Crummell, my understanding from talking with the bill's proponents, which I have done, is that this is being brought forward because there's a specific concern about a school that is having a hard time finding a water supply, particularly in the late summer months. And so this was one of the, I guess, alternatives that was put on the table in terms of how this water supply problem might be resolved. And again, our approach to this is to try to work with that school and the community to resolve that problem specifically.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Another question? Thank you, Adam.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Very quickly, Doug Myers, Water Watch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Doug Myers, and I am representing Water Watch. And in the interest of brevity and the absence of any proponent, I'll just submit my written testimony and ask if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Any questions for Doug? The written testimony will be part of the committee, the folder on this, and thank you for the brevity of that.
I know you appreciate that.
Uh-huh. At this point, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2473, and we want to open a public hearing on HJM 10. And we have Representative Roblin here. Would you like to explain to us what we wanted on HJM 10? Thank you.
For the record, my name is Arnie Roblin. I'm Representative House District 9 and a member of the Coastal Caucus that has been meeting, and this bill comes from that group, this memorial. The events that took place in the Indian Ocean this last year made it more evident than ever. We've been spending a lot of effort on the coast preparing for tsunamis, and one of the issues that we have currently with some stuff that Mark Hatfield did many, many years ago in the first tsunami preparedness legislation at the federal government. What we're asking for here is to recognize the efforts that Senator Wyden and Smith are doing currently with Senate Measure 50 back in the federal Congress to update that with some more buoy warning systems. Also, advanced mapping, a second generation of mapping, and how the coastline will be inundated in case of a tsunami. It also, that bill also covers research to find out where the most direct routes and what routes will probably happen. And people have asked that the buoys themselves don't necessarily help with the subduction zone earthquake that we could have off the coast. And the answer to that is that's true. There are a bunch of other things in this bill besides the buoy system that we have out in the Pacific right now. What it does do, it takes care of another type of tsunami, which is actually a lot more dangerous in the sense that you have no warning. With a subduction zone earthquake, you're going to have a large earthquake ahead of time you know to get away from, and we're hopefully building better and better resources at the coast to get people off. But underwater landslides that take place, the last big one that I remember saying about was in the Atlantic, but that take place, displace water, which creates a tsunami without any forewarning from an earthquake. Those tsunamis sometimes are much higher, come very quickly across the ocean, and without the buoy system you wouldn't know that it was happening. Also, earthquakes that happen on the other side of the Pacific Ocean, which we don't feel, send tsunamis across the ocean at times, and it's the buoy system that gives us the warning and the advanced knowledge to get away from the coastline. The bill also talks about preparedness and having water stores and others. I also have some testimony from Amit Hussing from OCZMA that I'll just enter in after I'm done. But we believe, as a Coastal Caucus and me in particular, that the bill that is being looked at the federal level is one that we should support as a coastal state here in Oregon. Thank you. And I entertain any questions.
Am I correct, Representative, then, that in addition to your sponsoring the bill, that this is a unanimous consent or an agreement on the part of the Coastal?
Each member of the Coastal Caucus signed on to this bill, Representative Brown being one of those.
Yes. Okay. And memory has it, and memory fades in and out for me from time to time, but memory has it that scientific community has said there's something like a 10% chance of a major tsunami in the next 25 years. Is that?
Yes, and that is 10 to 15%. It's also in Mr. Husing's information. The last major tsunami subduction zone earthquake was about 300 years ago. There is still evidence of it on the coast, including the South Sioux Sanctuary. There's a place that people come and visit to look at a drop in the land mass that took place there. It created a large tsunami that was recorded both here and in Japan when it hit there the next day. So we know that it happens, that it's been irregular, but within every 500 years or so, there is a major tsunami. It's been about 300 years ago since the last one that's recorded.
And could you help me a little bit, Representative, with what you're doing on the coast right now?
Up and down the coast, there is going to be a tsunami summit that the Coastal Caucus people are working with. We had a meeting here about 2 weeks ago with emergency prepared people from all up and down the coast. That is continuing, and there will be a tsunami summit here in the capital coming up next month to talk about what it is that we need to do and what we can do to prepare. The big issue is to make sure that people who visit the coast and people who live there start getting educated as to what to do in case of a large earthquake. And secondarily, to get information to each of the communities. We have begun, and the North Coast has done a good job of getting sirens on all the beaches that indicate move away from the beach, tsunami warning. That has now covered the entire coast, but with different sirens. We're working on getting that standardized. Also, making sure that we have an inventory of what kind of stores we have, water and other kinds of things. The issue that we know will happen if there's a real subduction zone earthquake is the valley is also going to feel that a lot. Being ready and prepared with our local people to handle 3 or 4 days without other help is going to be important. So all of those things, education is a major part of this whole process.
Thank you.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just add a little bit to what Representative Rowland said, that in the last tsunami, major tsunami I know of, to hit the Oregon coast in 1964 with the Alaskan earthquake, and the there was one fatality in Oregon, and that was on the beaches there at Newport when it happened. The coast now is in different levels of preparedness. One of the best ones I've seen is up in Tillamook County. They've been working very hard on this and have developed a warning system, and they're placed in their tourist facilities escape route maps. So it's the best way for the people that aren't familiar with our area to get to high ground, essentially, is what it amounts to. And have in place some warning siren systems, and they've done a great deal of work up there. And so up and down the coast as a whole, we're at different levels. Some have done very little, and others have done a great deal. And so that's the need for this tsunami preparedness task force to put it all together so we're all at that upper level. We don't know. It might be 25 years, but as the last major one from the subduction zone that's just directly off Newport, is it's been 300 years. And the impact that will have, if it should happen on there, is not only going to be on the coast, it's going to be here in the valley, too. Mm-hmm. And so there'll be a lot of damage inland as well as right along the coast. So we'll have to be able to manage by ourselves for some time, because you guys and the people here in the valley will have their hands full too and won't be able to come immediately to our rescue. Thank you, Representative.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Roblin and Representative Roblin. And my apologies for having to have you wait for a few minutes while we were. Had I known you were going to be here, I would have put this one on first and
not a problem at all. And I was scurrying around to let people know at the other committee, and so I knew I was a little late. So I appreciate the speediness with
blinking.
Thank you very much.
Surely. I have Vicki. Is it McConnell?
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Vicki McConnell. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries and the designated state geologist of Oregon. And I just wanted to add a couple of other statements to Representative Roblin's testimony. My agency is strongly in support of, and we commend you, and we commend the Coastal Caucus for writing this this memorial. We think it's a wonderful idea to show the congressional senators our support on something as important as this type of bill that they're working on back there. And just a couple of bits of, just a little bit of information on the written testimony. What I've done is listed some of the things that have occurred to help us. Oregon is one of the coasts that we should be very proud of ourselves because we've done a lot of work towards tsunami preparedness through the years, both at a legislative level and through some of the work from the state and local agencies. And so the big, the biggest thing that the Tsunami Preparedness Act bill would do, that Senate 50 in the congressional, would be to beef up the existing tsunami preparedness mitigation program that is now in place. Much of that is that information that we've received, that continuing education, continuing research, and continuing science, so that we always know that we're a little ahead of the curve on what the information is that we need. However, we generally have used most of the funding that we have received for tsunami work has been through the NOAA, through this tsunami hazard mitigation program. And so we are very happy to see our senators working with the other five Pacific states, or the other four Pacific states, to keep that work in place. And I'm happy to answer any questions about either the geology or the hazard or the bill. Thank you so much.
Are there any questions? Representative Brown.
This is not necessarily to do with tsunamis, but I wanted to tell the committee that I had the opportunity to attend a seminar that Vicki and her staff put on at Lincoln City here a year ago, and I learned it. And I've lived on the Oregon coast and on the right next to the beaches for 33 years now, and I learned more there in 2 days about beaches than I did in that 33 years.
Chair Jensen, Representative Brown, thank you very much, and I'll be happy to come and talk about your metasequoia tomorrow, too.
I need the help. I can't even spell it.
I think the one issue or possible question that that I have, and I don't know whether we'll be able to put it in our schedule, but I do know that over that we've had the department has been before legislative committee before with a with presentation about tsunamis, and I guess I'm wondering, and I don't know what our schedule, whether we can schedule it now or not. But I'm wondering whether you would be available and willing to come back with such a presentation at some time.
Chair Jensen and committee members, if we can work it all into our mutual schedule, we would be happy to do that. I would like to reiterate what Representative Roblin said about the Tsunami Summit. That is scheduled to take place on April 7th. In Hearing Room E here at the Capitol, 3:30 to 5. And it's really going to be a distillation. It'll be a very quick, succinct distillation of the work, the most recent workshop we had with the recovery and response folks, where we'll bring the message of where are those gaps still as the people on the ground see where the issues are. And we'd like to bring it before legislative, before the governor, and before our congressional folks. And I will tell you also that Senate 50, the congressional, this Tsunami Preparedness Act, both Senator Smith and Wyden have worked with Office of Emergency Management and my agency, as well as several other OCZMA and several other local and state agencies to work on the language of that bill. So it's well known to all of us, and they've been very responsive to all of our issues.
Thank you very much. If there's no other questions, then appreciate your being here and with your testimony today.
Thank you.
Is that all? Mm-hmm. Having no other testimony today present on HJM 10, We will close our public hearing on HJM 10 and ask staff to put this on our Friday work session agenda. Okay. And with that, I've got the... Wait a minute.
Well, and Mr. Chair, also attached to the copy of the bill that was paper-clipped, the Tsunami Preparedness Act spelled out, provided by staff, the office staff, for your information, too, which helps give you a... should be paper-clipped to the bill.
Oh, got it. Thank you.
So, anyway, just to bring it to your attention. Thank you.
I'm going to reopen the public hearing on 2473, and that's the one we're on. Oh, excuse me, on HJM 10. Looking at the wrong piece of paper. And we have a report from the Oregon, or testimony, I think, from the Oregon Coastal Zone Management Association in hard copy that has been given to us today, and make that a part of the official record for the committee hearing. With that, I'll close again the public hearing on HJM 10. And I would like at this time to open a public hearing on House Bill 2522. And I see that we have Representative Dahlem here to testify on House Bill 2522. And if you would, please, Representative, welcome. And if you have folks from your want to come up with you, that would be great. That would be Mr. Seil and Mr. Parker. Is that reasonably close?
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you. Welcome, Representative.
Thank you, Chairman Jensen and representatives of the committee. I'd like to also thank you for hearing this bill. It is a very important matter in our community, the community of the Dalles. I was asked if I would submit legislation to cure an existing problem of trespass in the city watershed. With help from the city attorney and the public works director, I did just that. For the hearing today, I have brought with me Brian Stahl, public works director for the city of the Dalles. He is directly responsible for the Dalles City watershed. And I have brought with me city attorney Gene Parker. And I will leave the testimony to them as they have chapter, verse, and details. And with that, Mr. Stahl.
Okay. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Brian Stahl. I'm the Director of Public Works. Chairman Jensen and members of the committee, we appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today. There's a number of points that I would make specifically related to the management of the watershed. The cities and municipalities through the state and also Homeland Security have the distinction of having to manage municipal resources, water supplies, reservoirs, and watersheds. Watersheds are critical elements that we have related to that, the whole management scheme. What municipalities need in managing these resources is to try to have as many tools in the toolbox that we can use to make sure that the water supply is protected. Protection of the watershed is distinctly important to the city of the Dalles because we have the unenviable position of being the only municipality in the entire country that has experienced a bioterrorism attack, which happened in the mid-1980s with the Rajneeshis and Rajneeshpuram, that there were definite attacks on our water supply at that time by those individuals. What this will do for us by increasing the fines in the 50s is when the original ORS was created. Obviously, at that time, it was very important to the state legislators that municipal watersheds in particular, be given specific protections and a specific identification. $100 back in the 1950s. Was a fairly decent monetary fine. In this day and age, it is not. So we are requesting consideration of increasing that fee.
Okay.
or charge, I should say.
Fees are bad. Representative Jensen and
whichever works best for you.
Representative Jensen, members of the committee, I'm for the record, I'm Gene Parker, the city attorney. As Brian mentioned, since September of 1957, the city's had an ordinance on the books that's regulated access to the city's watershed and established penalties. Under current state law, we've been restricted to a penalty of $100 or a jail sentence of up to 30 days or a combination of both of those penalties. It's been our experience that the minimum penalty of $100 has not been a real deterrent to people who want to trespass in our watershed, okay, to poach animals or engage in other illegal activity. Our records show from September of 1996 to December of 2004, we've cited 18 people into our court for violating our ordinance. The typical fine that's been imposed by the court has been $125, which is not a very large fine. Our court has never sentenced anyone to jail yet because we want to reserve that jail for more significant violations. But the $125 fine really is a pretty minimal penalty. What we're seeking in the legislation is to increase the penalty to what's equivalent for a Class C misdemeanor. Under current law, 30 days in jail is the maximum that a defendant can get for a Class C misdemeanor. And the maximum penalty is currently $1,250, so we're seeking to increase that monetary fine to be equivalent to a Class C misdemeanor. We feel that will be an important tool to deter this kind of activity and help protect our watershed. There might be a question about why we can't use the criminal trespass statute, and our concern there is that to be able to prosecute someone under that statute, we have to show that the defendant acted with knowledge or intent. And we typically get defendants who are up in the watershed who will claim, oh, they didn't see the sign that clearly says don't trespass, or they'll argue they didn't know where the boundaries of the watershed is. And with the current law, we don't have to get into issues of intent or knowledge. The bill just talks about restricting access. It also proposes to take out the specific types of activities that we currently restrict and allows us to control access for any purpose, which would be favorable to us. But it doesn't get into issues about intent or knowledge, so we feel that it's a better ordinance to protect our watershed other than the criminal trespass. So, again, we're asking for your support in the legislation to increase the penalties to make sure that we send a message to people that we don't want them up there. Engaging in those activities are not proper.
Questions?
Yes.
Representative Barnes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is for the attorney. I'm assuming that there are much higher penalties for people who not only are trespassing but are there for the purpose of adulterating the water in some way or causing damage to the watershed in some way. Is that true?
As Chair Jensen and Representative Barnhart, I think there could be. Certainly other criminal trespass statutes do carry a more severe penalty, such as criminal trespass in the first degree is an A misdemeanor, which now is a $6,250 fine and a year in jail. But that's typically a trespass on a residence. A criminal mischief in the second degree is, again, a C misdemeanor. That would be the same penalties here as we're proposing, the 12, 15, 30 days in jail. There are other criminal mischief statutes when you damage property. I don't know whether they specifically apply to a watershed, but I'm not aware if it's another specific bill or statute that deals with damage to the watershed itself. There is a criminal trespass in the possession of a firearm that I believe is a higher misdemeanor, which we could possibly cite some of these people with if they actually are carrying a weapon while they're crossing in the watershed. But to actually damage, or like I say, adulterate the water, I don't believe there's currently a statute that specifically deals with that.
Well, if I could follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
What we've heard so far from Representative Dahlem is that this is the one watershed that was actually attacked in the 80s, and presumably in a way that might have led to some health problems for people. I have a vague recollection of that. I lived in Oregon in the 80s, and we've followed some of that, even in Eugene. I guess I'm a little concerned if these penalties are sufficient to deal with that kind of a problem, or whether there are some other statutes that would deal with that sort of problem if it could be proved.
If I might answer that question, Representative Barnett, what we're attempting to do is to limit the traffic, and if somebody is in trespass and we go up there, we're not going up there on a simple poaching or hunting without permission or wandering and hiking into the watershed. What we're trying to do is limit the traffic. So if someone's in there, we take it very seriously. That's the major thrust of the bill.
Okay, if I could follow up. I'm really asking about the opposite kind of problem. Not somebody who's just kind of wandering by, but somebody who actually intends to cause some harm. And do we have other laws on the books now that would provide a greater penalty for somebody who actually was in the watershed for the purpose of hurting people by going up there? As I understand, perhaps the Rajneeshis may have intended back in the 80s. I'm assuming without knowing that we actually have a different law that would provide a greater penalty, because my observation is that this penalty doesn't get there for somebody who's really trying to harm people.
Lieutenant Governor, Chair Jensen, again, I'm not the district attorney, but I would think that that kind of potential crime, if there's somebody that goes in the watershed with the intent to kill people or certainly poison them or something, that that could raise the level of certainly maybe attempted murder perhaps or something, or some sort of assault where you could prove that there was an intent to cause serious injury or bodily harm. And I don't know whether the current statutes define those toxins as a deadly weapon, but I would think the district attorney might argue that at this point you're getting a level of, you know, felony assaults potentially or something like that.
Okay.
That kind of serious matter, I think, would fit that kind of crime.
Thank you. And I have a question on a slightly different topic, if I could.
Please.
Thank you. I take it that the watershed is now posted for trespassing, that there's some signs around, at least in the more obvious places.
Mm-hmm.
And would it be the intention to maintain that signage, continue it, despite the fact that this law doesn't require that people actually know that they're trespassing?
Yeah.
I guess I could answer that. Chair Jensen, Representative Barnhart, yes, we would anticipate maintaining the closure signs. We actually... Our watershed has a lot more accessibility than, say, Portland to Bull Run, because we're ringed with roadways. So what we typically do is we sign far greater than what is required. So it's one-tenth every two-tenths of a mile we have signs posted. So there's really very, very little excuse of not having seen a sign.
Thank you. And in fact, if I may, Mr. Chair, the last two lines of the statute currently deal with that issue, because it says there that it's a defense if the area isn't posted. So I hadn't read that until just now. Thank you very much.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Of the 18 violations, can you tell us what they were cited for?
Yes, Representative Tomei and Chair Jensen, they were cited for a violation of our city ordinance, which basically, with shorthand version, we call it trespass in the watershed. But we cited them all for violation of our ordinance. And I believe that when I signed most of those complaints, they were charged as a violation. I don't believe ever I could charge the person with a misdemeanor, which would carry the 30-day jail sentence. But a lot of times these were first offenders. A lot of times they're people out of the area who are up there looking for mushrooms or other things. And a lot of times it's hunters going outside the boundaries, but they were cited for violation of our ordinance.
That's helpful. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My questions were answered.
Your questions were answered. Are there other questions? I have no questions. I merely have an observation or concern, which I'll share with you before we close the public hearing on this. And that is whether it would be appropriate for me to refer this to the Judiciary Committee. And I suspect maybe that they have enough bills in Judiciary right now to keep them busy. But by the same token, before I take action on it, you'll want to know that I am going to pursue whether that would be an appropriate action to take before we move the bill in committee. And for Representative Dahlem, we wouldn't have this and don't have it on work session today. It's generally the policy of the chair, where I can, not to
work bills on the first time that there's a public hearing on them. So we'll be coming back one way or another on this bill. And if we will post it for Friday of this week for a work session, understanding that that may not take place if the chair of the Judiciary Committee wants to hear the bill.
Thank you, Chairman Jensen, and I'll keep in touch, and we'll follow the bill as it's posted. Thank you very much for your time and your patience with us.
Thank you, Representative, for being here, and thank you, gentlemen, for being here. Hope that we can help you with your problem.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sure. Members of the committee.
With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2522, and we seem to, at this point, we'll open a public hearing on HJM 7, and we'll make the announcement that this is being held over because the sponsor of the bill is unable to be here today. With that, we will close the public hearing on HJM 7. And at this point, we'll close the public hearings and open a work session on House Bill 2472. And it must be that I have all of the professionals in the room waiting with bated breath to come forward. Please, Adam.
Dave.
Come on, both.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2472 we heard on Friday, and we asked, the chair requested that we put this up for a work session and give the department, otherwise known as Mr. Leland, a chance to look at. The chair had requested that he look at the pilot project of that the Water Resources did at the direction of the legislature, and I sent the information to Dave, and he's come back to give us his findings.
Excellent, Sandy. It's poor taste for me to offer any correction to staff's thing on this, but reference that you're making to the Water Resource Department, I believe that bill came to us from the Water Resource Department, and it was merely the legislature which gave the department the authorization to go ahead with that. If I'm wrong on that, I'll be glad for Adam to correct me at some
point.
Okay. Oh, okay.
We were talking in another bill.
Are you here?
Yes. Okay.
Dave.
Good afternoon, Chair Jensen, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Dave Leland with the Department of Human Services, where I manage the Safe Drinking Water Program. I have completed a request by Chair Jensen to look into the receipts authority applicability to our discussions about House Bill 2472. I did that, and thanks also to the committee administrator for helping me with the bill numbers and citations. So I did locate those relevant bill numbers, and I know a lot more about receipts authority today than I did on Friday. So I looked those over.
Wanted to know.
Well, it was very interesting.
Oh, okay.
It was very interesting. Kind of my key conclusion after studying those is that Water Resource Department, of course, issues a certificate or permit, which constitutes their formal permission that a water user has to have before the water user can appropriate water. And if there's a delay in that process, there can be some economic impacts of that, and so water users, of course, can be very anxious to get that transaction completed so that they can go on with whatever economic use or planning activities that they have where that permission's a prerequisite. And so this receipts authority, as I understand it, then allows the water user who needs that permission quickly to, in effect, sign an agreement to help pay for that expedited review and to get that done a little quicker, kind of move to the head of the line or get things done in the way that they need. In terms of the drinking water statute, though, we really don't issue any certificates or permits or kind of permission to operate kinds of things. So I really wasn't able to see how that could be directly applied to our work. People generally aren't, the things that we do generally are not a prerequisite for someone's, having a water system in the first place in the same way that Water Resource Department approves using water before the entity can actually go and get the water out of the stream or out of the ground. So I didn't see direct applicability for what we're trying to do here.
Indirect?
Well, I think, and of course, as we're talking about the fee bill from the Drinking Water Task Force, that is, in terms of paying for the water system inspections, that seems like a more applicable way to do this rather than, someone trying to get it first or paying for it to have it done more often. So I'm just not seeing how we could really make that work with the way the drinking water statute is set up.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do we have any other questions then for Mr. Leland today on the... At which point we are in a work session. I would entertain a motion if anybody is so brave as to make one.
Mr. Chair, before we make a motion, could we discuss it among ourselves?
But of course.
I'm just of mixed feelings in this, and I guess I'd like to know how other people view this.
And what are your mixed feelings, if I could ask, Representative?
Well, my brain is similar to the brain that you have described in forgetting things. I'm trying to come back to, was it Friday we discussed this?
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I was going to make a comment, and I agree with
you. She seems to think she
thank
can
you.
I think I can help. I think I understand. Maybe great minds think alike. What Representative Tomei is struggling with, because I struggle with the same issue, in that, in a way, unfortunately, it seems like we're lowering the bar of safety and protecting Oregonians as far as the quality of their drinking water, because we don't have the resources to enforce the safe drinking water law. And I do think that, unfortunately, it is bad public policy, although I'm not inclined to vote necessarily against this bill. However, I think it sends the wrong message to Oregonians that, well, we don't have the money to protect your health, so we'll just relax the standards of the bill. And that's, unfortunately, a concern that I have about by saying, when I had asked you about how many FTE you would need to implement this program correctly and to the full extent, if we're talking about 5 FTE is what I had written down in my notes. But unfortunately, because we are in the situation where we've had to play, I guess, triage on so many important health issues, that the department is saying they can't enforce this unless they have more resources. And I think the response should be that we should help try to find the resources for the department instead of relaxing the standards. So that's my concern about this, and I don't know if that helps jog your memory.
Yes.
But unfortunately, I think we can say that for all of the regulations that protect human health. And this is one of the most important acts, I think, that was passed as far as making sure we have clean drinking water, which is a problem in a huge part of the world. And we're fortunate that we have the availability, the technology, to make sure that we are drinking good quality water. So I'll stop editorializing on that note.
Thank you, Representative Dingfelder. So, Mr. Chair, the gentleman who appeared before us has a real problem, and I feel like I don't want to stand in his way to get water. But I'm wondering if there's another way that we can help him rather than relaxing the restrictions that we have now.
Representative Brown.
I apologize. I missed the hearing the other day, so I didn't hear what was presented in regarding this. I introduced the bill on behalf of Don Butch because he explained to me what his situation mm-hmm. was with him and his neighbors and their cabins. And then what this bill will do will align Oregon statute the same as federal statute. Was there any testimony from anybody to say that, you know, that the federal statutes weren't safe? And so we're just making assumptions that at this level, then these aren't safe drinking water standards then. In the federal, but this is a federal law.
Right? I really should ask Dave to clarify because I don't think that's really what we're saying.
Chair Jensen and Representative Brown, our state statute basically goes down to a lower threshold to determine a public water system. So we regulate water systems in Oregon from 4 connections and up rather than 15 and up. So we cover all of them. We apply the same actual standards to all the public water systems. The smaller systems typically have less testing to do, you know, because they're smaller and whatnot. But there is basic testing, at least in the requirements, the same basic standards that are under the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act, for example, for bacteria and nitrates and things of that nature. So we just what we do is apply those standards to smaller water systems than the federal government applies to. Does that answer the question?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does.
May I ask Dave a question?
You may.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In having this 15 number as a threshold limit in the Safe Drinking Water Act, do you know how it was purely economics that number was devised? Or, you know, because the likelihood of needing testing at 14 versus 15, I'm assuming there was some cost-benefit analysis that was done, and it was decided at the federal level that it wasn't cost-effective to test less than 15, or at the state. Can you talk about maybe the difference between, and I don't know if you've gone back and read the legislative history, but it would be interesting to know how we at the state came up with 4 versus 15 at the federal Safe Drinking Water Act level.
Chair Jensen, Representative Dingfelder, I could probably shed a little bit of light on that. The federal legislation actually predates the state legislation. So the federal legislation was in 1974. The state legislation is 1981. And so by 1981, there had been some considerable experience with the federal drinking water regulations here in Oregon as carried out directly by US EPA at the time because the Oregon declined primacy for the Safe Drinking Water Act early on. Mm-hmm. It was actually one of the last few mm-hmm. states to take primacy. So while I don't think I can really speak to all the legislative history of both of those things, the 81 Act is a little bit before my time, although I'll admit not much before my time. I have to assume that was the picking the 4 connection number was pretty intentional by the legislature at that time.
Okay, thank you.
Comments or questions? Representative Byner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have the same comment to make that Representative Brown made earlier, and I was involved with other matters and was unable to attend the hearing on Friday. I'm having trouble understanding what the sub 2 in this statute refers to. It looks like it's talking about a housing subdivision of 15 or more living units, but where the water connections serve fewer than 15 per water system. At first, the way I read that was that the water systems could be subject to regulation for if they were smaller than 15 at the discretion of the Director of Human Services. But that isn't what this says, not quite. Could you explain again? You probably said it already on Friday, but could you explain it again what this section means?
Chair Jensen and Representative Barnhart, this section in the state statute again dates from the original act, which was 1981. And I think the purpose of Section 2, this is the one in a housing subdivision of a certain number of living units where you've got, you know, just the subdivision is sort of broken up into several smaller water systems. That I think that was written as sort of a way to keep people from kind of deliberately avoiding being covered under the statute. So in other words, a developer might go in and put in 300 units and then put every 3 units on a well. And so, you know, you'd have a whole bunch of water systems, they're all in one place, but none of them really come up to the threshold of regulation, and you end up with a potentially bad public health situation where you have a lot of, you know, almost individual wells serving all the houses. I think that was the intent of that section, too.
So then a follow-up, if I may.
Follow-up.
So under this statute, at least, as under this bill, 2472, if the housing subdivision has fewer than 15 units, the director cannot get the authority to regulate. If the total of the subdivision is less than 15,
I think that's correct.
Okay,
Representative Barnhart. You know. But and let me just say, in this case, with the revision here, let's say you had maybe 30 housing units, and it was broken down. It was all one subdivision, but it's broken into 3 10-unit subdivisions, each with its own water system. It looks like this section would still have give the administrator some authority to say, now wait a minute, no, that's 30 houses, that's a public water system, even if you split it up.
Mr. Chair, help me remember it. When Mr. Butch made his presentation on Friday, as I recall in reading his materials, they were willing to have their water examined, but by Marion County could not afford the staff to do that. Am I correct? Okay. So they cannot, people are afraid that they might not be able to sell their property because they don't have the certificate that says they've got clean water. It seems to me that one of us asked the question of him, why don't you pay to have it done yourself? And apparently one of the residents, maybe the person who lives there permanently, has had it tested more than once and no problem existed. I'm sort of remembering back to other issues that are brought before us when we're trying to expedite studies. And so people can pay to have an expert that's been certified do their study. I'm wondering if I can appreciate this problem, the problem of other people in this housing development, but I'm wondering why we couldn't suggest to them that they hire an expert to do the testing if that's their problem in selling it. See what I mean? And get a certificate that says this is safe water instead of us changing a whole state law for this.
Yes. Could we ask that? Can that be done?
Chair Jensen and members of the committee. Let me just say, I I've talked with Mr. Bush also about his situation, and he indicated that his problem primarily was dealing with his water right. He had an issue about his water right that he's working with the Water Resources Department on. And arising during that discussion is where Mr. Bush discovered that he, you know, also technically met the criteria to be a public water system under our statute. But that doesn't cross over to his issue with Water Resources Department and getting his water right situation squared away there. So
they're different issues.
They're different issues, but and I'm not really sure. I never really did get a satisfactory answer to why, you know, why he was sort of directed. Maybe Adam can help with that. Why he was kind of directed to the county health department. I didn't get a good answer for that. Maybe Adam can help us with that.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, again, Adam Sussman with Water Resources Department. And I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with the particular case, but certainly as we work with water users to make a water right transfer, to do some transaction, we may come across a situation where there's seven or eight connections in a water system, and we simply will notify them of other state requirements that they should be aware of and put them in touch with the appropriate agency. That's simply a information role that we provide sometimes while we're working with water users.
Follow-up, please.
Follow-up.
So, Adam, do you share my concern that we're changing a whole state law for one situation? And even that may not be, because it doesn't sound like he's trying to sell his property, only he just became notified of this state requirement. So if he were to sell his property, he might feel like there was a cloud on that, but that's not the situation he's in now.
Representative Jensen, Representative Tomei, I'm not sure I'm the best person to speak to, you know, what impact it has on the state's ability to protect safe drinking water. And I guess, defer to Mr. Leland about whether he thought that was a reasonable thing to do.
Thank you, Adam. And what do you think?
Representative Tomei and Chair Jensen, I think that answers the question I had. And that, yes, he just became aware that there are safe drinking water requirements, but it's not part of his, his action with Water Resources to get his water right done. Now, that being said, sure, if you, it's just like selling your own house with your own well. You know, you might have to demonstrate to the buyer that the water's okay. And in fact, and there are labs out there that do those kinds of tests, and you can do that.
Right.
You can do that on your own.
Right. I guess for that reason, Mr. Chair, I'm in
Clark. Clark Representative, you remember, I think, that was the reason for my request. I mean, this whole thing is a reason for my request to see if the people can't pay for it themselves. And I expect that, rather more than just going out and getting a private person, contractor, what have you, to do it, that there may be, and I don't know that the individual isn't here now, but the idea might be that there's something of a security blanket if whatever's been done is done under the umbrella of the public health, even though they may have to wind up paying for themselves.
With all respect, we don't know in this body, I think, why it was changed from the federal requirement of, 15?
Let's hold it.
Down to 4. So I guess I'm still uncomfortable about changing a law that may not need to be changed.
Mr. Chair, I have a question for either Dave or Adam, if they can answer it, and that is, with this type of thing, what do other states, particularly states in the Northwest, do? I mean, I guess we could say, you know, we're trying to protect Oregonians, but it also sort of reaches a point where are we regulating to the point of ridiculousness? So, what do other states do? Idaho, Washington, Montana, so on.
Representative Cremel and Chair Jensen, I am aware that the state of Washington goes down to 2 connections for a public water system. And I think Idaho and Alaska both are at federal definition threshold levels. But I do know that Washington goes down to 2.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. So they're down to 2 if there's 2 service connections, but for example, in section 1 of this it says that are used regularly by at least 25 individuals. Do they have an upper number that have to be using it on a regular basis, or is it just flat out if it's 2 connections, then it's regulated?
They just have 2 as the floor, and then similar to how we do things, there are different types of water systems, you know, laid out within the whole range from 2 connections all the way up to the city of Seattle. And so they have different size categories for establishing their testing requirements and all of that. They do, yes.
Okay, and follow up, Mr. Chair. And then do they also have language similar to what we have in Section 2, or subsection 2 of this bill, relative to subdivisions and the number of living units and so on?
I don't believe they do, and simply because they go down to 2 connections already. But I could certainly check on that, but I'm not aware that they try to regulate individual wells as a public water system. Then as that would be the situation they would be in.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Thank
You're
you,
welcome.
Mr. Chair.
Okay, we're going to hold this bill over for a little further investigation. And with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2472. And I'll wait a little bit before making a determination when it should, if it does reappear. And I'll work with Representative Brown and his constituent, or I guess it is his constituent now, even though
he has the properties over here.
Yeah, properties over here. To see if we can answer and iron out some of those issues. And let's see, I have a couple of announcements before we close today, just for the committee. We did move 2025 to the floor, and with a rescinding of the Ways and Means referral. We will be offering, when House Bill 2066 comes to us, it was scheduled on the consent calendar today, and as you noted, it was held, it was pulled from the consent calendar.
Are you happy now? Okay, thank you. Sorry about that. When it comes back to us, or when it does come up on the floor, we will be referring that bill to the House Committee or to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Part of the rationale or reasoning for that is that we did a very significant increase in the department's license fees 2 years ago, and there needs to be some discussion as far as that bill is concerned as to whether or not the payment of those amount, the amount of money to the sellers of those licenses cannot come out of the fee money that is currently being collected for that, or whether or not that would, what that would exactly do to the department's cash flow situation. So the Ways and Means area is a much more appropriate place for that discussion to take place than it is for us, and we will simply refer it on then to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. So that, and my reason for talking about this now is so that you all are familiar and you don't think that something is being done behind your back that you're unaware of, and you know, kind of look at me like startled, what are you doing to me? And in relationship to this, I knew nothing about this until I looked on the consent calendar today and saw that it was there, and then had the, you know, holdover or on it, or the change to the third reading calendar, and investigation kind of brought this out, and I thought the easiest way to solve it is merely to send it to Ways and Means to begin with, rather than harangue it on the floor when folks might not know what was going on with it. So, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Was it the chair's announcement that the fluoride bill is going to Ways and Means,
no,
or is not going to Ways and Means?
It is going to the floor.
Thank you.
It's been
that. Is that correct?
Today.
Today. We are adjourned.